Session number 21095, Real 4.
No, I was going
Hella Pick, Real 4.
The second time I went to Auschwitz was with the Polish Pope. I cannot remember now whether it was during his first or his second visit to Poland, but it must have been around either 19. He became Pope in 1978, and this could have been either in 79 or in 80. And he was doing a big tour of Poland, and it was a marvelous happening, because for the first time, it must have been before 1980, it must have been in 1979, because for the first time, Poles in huge numbers, I mean, in their hundreds of thousands, turned up wherever he was, and, you know, they realized that they had a voice, that they could speak for themselves. But that's a Cold War story, which we'll come back to, I'm sure. But anyway, one of his ports of call was Auschwitz, where he was due to hold a service, a mass. Now, apart from the mere fact of going back to Auschwitz, there were three things there that were just awful. First of all, he directed his attention really only towards the Catholics who had died in Auschwitz. They had invited no rabbis onto the platform from where he was conducting his mass. They had brought in a lot of survivors from Auschwitz who were sitting there in their striped pajamas or their habits, and they were mostly Catholic survivors. They had not invited Jewish survivors. Then we, the media, during the mass, were put onto the slopes where the railways ended, where the trains had disgorged the victims, and the telephones for the press had been installed in the watchtowers. So, you know, there we were in these sort of circumstances, and again, it was very hard. I mean, you know, I obviously wrote a story from that because it was an important event, and I think I was more able to cope with it than I had been on the first visit, but it still was an awful feeling, and I remember I discussed it afterwards with, she died recently, you know, the woman who was married to Group Captain Cheshire, Sue Ryder, who had been on that trip because she always had Polish connections, and I talked to her about that afterwards, and she agreed with me, and she, in spite of being such a strong supporter of the Pope, she felt that this had really been a mistake. And then the third time I went to Auschwitz was with Simon Wiesenthal, when I went with him in, I think, 94, when he paid his first return visit to Poland since he left it while the concentration camps. And he was getting an honorary degree from the Jagiellonian University in Krakow. And before the ceremony, he had wanted to visit Auschwitz, and I went with him. And this time I had a completely different feeling about it, because it really has been turned into a museum now. I mean, it's not that the horror of it is still there, but the horror has been sanitized. Or perhaps I've become accustomed to it, I'm not sure, but I think it is more that it's all become more orderly, and there's a sort of museum which has been sort of done up as a museum, and it's just, it doesn't anymore convey the sheer horror of what went on there. It's just some happening in the past. And curiously, I remember we were about half a dozen with Wiesenthal, and included in the group was the then Polish ambassador to Vienna, who knew him very well and who was a terribly talkative man and never stopped talking. But he said to me, because we were all going to have lunch together afterwards back in Krakow, and he said to me, look, I think, you know, I'm sure that Simon would just want to be quiet and possibly left to himself, and maybe we should just have lunch by ourselves. And Simon said, we'll all have lunch together, won't we? And then we sat down at this lunch, and he and this Polish ambassador to Vienna kept on telling each other humorous stories and joking. And I thought, this is so curious that Wiesenthal somehow is reacting in this completely detached way to a place which, after all, had so much meaning for him. I mean, he had been in a railway coach which had been brought to Auschwitz, but at the time Auschwitz was so full they couldn't take any more loads, so they were moved on to another concentration camp. So he'd never got out of the train, so to that extent he was fortunate. But nevertheless, I found that very, very curious. And, you know, he might have been earlier on in his life, but he wasn't at that stage any longer the sort of person whom you could ask, why are you not reacting differently, or why have you reacted in this way? So I just let it go.
If I could return now to sort of the post-war, early post-war situation, and your concept of being a refugee during World War II, or the earlier part of it, and from what you've been telling me about your life in the Lake District, how much it would... I have read that you very much wanted to become integrated with your friends, and, you know, to the point of forgetting your German and certainly your Jewishness. So could I ask you a little more of this business of being a refugee and the enemy alien that you've mentioned and the effects it has on one?
I don't think that there were any lasting effects of being an enemy alien. In a way, you know, that, to think back on that, I find quite amusing and incongruous, and there was certainly no logic to attach an enemy alien's label to a small child. I do recall the extraordinary pleasure when I finally obtained my naturalization papers. That was, I think, in 1948. After the war, it was possible to apply, since obviously I had been resident in this country long enough to qualify. And I had no passport because the Austrian nationality had been taken from us. Oddly enough, I found a passport that belonged to my mother. I have found no passport belonging to me. But her passport, it is a German passport, which had a... is cancelled. You know, it could never be used again except for the outward journey from Austria to Britain. So, you know, we obviously had no travel papers. I remember the first time I went back to Austria, perhaps I didn't have the nationality then, because I remember, you know, you just got a very long piece of paper, some kind of piece of paper that was some kind of laissez-passer that allowed you to cross the borders and take them. Obviously, in those days, went by train. I wasn't flying. But I didn't have the passport. But getting the British nationality, I think at the time that was some confirmation that now I have ceased to be a refugee. I have somewhere again where I belong. And I think that went... The feeling that you're never quite 100% accepted as British, unless you were born in this country, I think that came much later, at a time when I spent a great deal of time with British officials during for my work at the Foreign Office with British diplomats and so on. And I always ask myself, you know, do they really all accept me completely as somebody wholly trustworthy, or am I still somehow, somewhere, something odd, something in the margins? This could have been pure imagination, because as it turned out, last year, that is in at the beginning of the year 2000, I was awarded the CBE, and that came on the recommendation. I was on the diplomatic list, which meant that it came on the recommendation of people connected with the Foreign Service. You obviously never find out exactly who was responsible for it, but I think I can guess more or less the people who were involved, and that's certainly meant both a former government minister and various senior diplomats. And so that, if any proof were needed that one is accepted, a CBE is, certainly should be good proof. And yet, I still have this feeling there's still something somewhere which doesn't quite get me to where I think I ought to be in terms of Britishness. For instance, I've never been invited to supply information to Who Is Who. I find that very curious. I've never made any overtures to them, but even if they hadn't done it before I got the CBE, I rather assumed that after the CBE that would happen, but it didn't. But, you know, that's a footnote to what I've been saying. But when I say that I'm damaged goods, is that I have always been conscious of a whole series of circumstances where I felt very insecure. And I think the insecurity does go back, to some extent at least, to the way in which I was uprooted, and to the way in which perhaps I don't feel 100% British either. I mean, this is a two-way traffic. And where I still feel I'm the outsider, I'm not really a 100% insider. And I think you know, it's reciprocal. Certainly it's the way that I see myself. I have been very curious to observe in myself the way in which I have become closer and closer to my original roots, to Austria. I can't say that I found find myself once again rooted in Austria, but I certainly feel very comfortable when I go to Austria now. And in this book on Austria that I've written, I have got a phrase somewhere that it has been a kind of homecoming for me. And people have asked me about that, and I've had to justify myself. I just feel at ease when I'm in Austria now, which is something that I certainly did not do at the beginning.
How did this happen over a long period? You're sort of coming to terms and feeling at ease in Austria. You know, that first visit, for instance, when you went in 1951, how did you feel then?
Oh, I felt a total outsider. I mean, somebody who'd come from Britain with my new Britishness, and as an observer and as a tourist, I didn't identify with the city at all. And this continued for many, many years, because on and off, I kept on going back to Austria. At first, it was just on holidays. My mother, well, as long as she was alive, tried at least once a year to go to a place called Bad Gastein, which is an Austrian spa, where her parents had always gone. And it's good for almost anything, but especially for arthritis. She had an arthritic knee, and she was fully convinced that as long as she went there once a year and took the baths, that her leg was all right, which, as it happens, it was. But she was a great believer in it, and I, even if I didn't spend the whole time with her, I'd always try and go and see her for a few days there. So I was going there. Then, after I started working for The Guardian and was back in Europe for The Guardian, Austria was sort of in my parish, to the extent that I would be parachuted in for election campaigns or for high-level East-West meetings. So I went to Vienna fairly regularly, but always for work. And I gradually got to know a lot of people, certainly all the sort of leading politicians and quite a lot of journalists in Vienna. So I became much more familiar with the place, but I still felt an outsider and a tourist. I never felt this is my city or my native city where I'm sort of fit in. And that really only started when I was working on the Wiesenthal book. Because for one thing, as he lives in Vienna, and a lot of the book had to be based on interviewing him, I went to Vienna quite a lot to talk to him, but also to do quite a lot of research. I was researching in the Kreisky archive there and various other places. And I was fortunate in that I have some friends in London who own a flat right in the very center of Vienna, which they never use and which they let out, which they rent out to friends who visit Vienna. And I've been able to use this flat most of the time when I've had to go to Vienna since then. And that has meant that I've got, I feel I have something approaching a home in Vienna. And it's made a huge difference to my whole feelings about the place, because and there's a cleaning woman whom I know, and there's a flower shop where I get my flowers, and there's a shoemaker across the street, and I take my shoes from London for him to mend because he's so good, and all kinds of things that make me feel very much at ease and at home. And of course I've got a lot more friends in Vienna now, which I've acquired partly through work, partly because one other element in this which I think was very important, the friends of mine who had lived in Austrian friends who had lived in London for years, he's called Wolfgang Fischer, he owned the Fischer Fine Arts Gallery, and they became very good friends here while they were living in England, and they moved back to Austria, and they have a house in on the Grundlsee, which is in the Ausseerland, which is a rather special part of the Austrian Alps. And they invited me to stay with them once, now some 7 or 8 years ago, up there. And I've been going back every summer since then. And again, I know this is a little bit like, for example, Cape Cod in America, where in the summer all the sort of intellectuals and actors and so on congregate there. So I know a lot of people there. Again, this is very much home from home now. And they're back in Vienna, and when I'm there, I see them and their friends and so on. So that has made a big difference. Possibly the biggest influence in forcing me to reconsider whether or not one can talk about, I can talk about Austria as home, has been someone called Hannes Androsch. Now, he was Kreisky's Minister of Finance in one of the, from 1970 till 78. I met him because I went to interview him as Minister of Finance, and somehow we became friends, and whenever he came to London when he was still Minister, I'd always meet him when he was here in London. And then Kreisky really destroyed his political name completely, and he was very unhappy, and somehow the whole of Vienna divided into his friends and his enemies, and I remained friends with him, and we've always kept in touch, and he's now Austria's biggest industrialist, and he was very helpful to me in various ways, including this last book on Austria, which he really to some extent sponsored, because he agreed to buy a certain number of copies, which made it financially secure enough for publishers to let me do it. And it was really his idea, the whole book. He suggested it to me. But anyway, he challenged me at some point, and he said, "Helen, don't you understand? In a way, you are making this your home again, and you should make it your home again." And he seems to have been, he triggered something off in me, which made me think about it more. So I think that it's always these sort of coincidences that I think add up to changing one's attitudes. And in this particular case, I think it has been quite important. I think the main thing is that, when I go to Vienna now, I know that I can pick up the phone and see friends, and we gossip about things. I know a lot of the sort of Viennese gossips and so on. I follow political affairs in Austria very closely. It interests me. And, of course, writing the book, because the book on Austria, I was asked what the idea was to write about Austria's image in the world since 45 as seen by an ex-Austrian. And this forced me to look at Austria again in ways in which I had certainly not looked at before, even though I'd done quite a lot of the spade work in the context of the Wiesenthal book. And I think just by learning a lot and thinking about this whole issue of whether Austria was a victim and how much it had lied to itself and continues to lie to itself about its wartime behavior, all of that, instead of turning me against Austria, has made me understand the whole situation better. I don't justify what has happened, but I think I do understand it better.
Do you have Austrian nationality then? Do you have
yes,
dual nationality?
Yes, I do have dual nationality, and that is actually quite an interesting story, because when I got to know Bruno Kreisky quite well when I was covering his election campaigns and so on, and he said to me one day, Helle, why don't you have your Austrian nationality back? And I said, but first I said, well, why should I? You know, it was taken from me. It's not a question of asking for it to be restored. It should just happen. And then I said, in any event, I'm certainly not prepared to take back my Austrian nationality unless I can also keep my British nationality. And at that time, it was against the Austrian law to have dual nationality, but exceptions could be made if the Austrian cabinet agreed to make an exception in favor of one particular individual. And Kreisky said, well, you know, I'm prepared to do that. And I said, no, I don't want it. And then I thought about it some more, and then I thought, well, this is really silly. I mean, if I've got the opportunity, why not? But by that time, he had stopped being chancellor. But I'd got to know his successor, a man called Sinowatz. And I can't remember how it went. I said it first to Hannes Androsch, this former finance minister, that I'd changed my mind about that. And I thought I'd want to do it because he said he'd certainly back it, because he knew Sinowatz very well. Anyway, one way or another, it got taken up by the Austrian government, and they did agree to give it to me. And I remember there was a little ceremony in the Austrian embassy here in London to hand me my sort of certificate or whatever. And it turned out there were only about two other ex-Austrians who had been given this privilege. That, of course, has all changed now, because after 91, when the Austrian government finally made its declaration of moral responsibility for what had happened during the war and so on, and they really embarked on a whole series of measures to ease the life of the ex-Austrians, the emigrants. They also changed the law so that because they wanted to encourage people to take back the old nationality, that everybody could hold dual nationality. And I think quite a lot of people have taken it up for various reasons, but certainly not everybody. But anyway, in my case, it really was a special arrangement. But I don't know whether that affected at all the way I thought about myself in terms of Britain or Austria. But I think that it does sort of reinforce my feeling that I belong nowhere and everywhere, you know, which I think is how I would sum it up.
Yes. Is that not a very positive thing to have? You know, this feeling that you know, leaving aside nowhere, the everywhere, to be a very cosmopolitan person, an internationalist.
I think so. I mean, I think it is, and I think this is one reason why I feel so strongly that the anti-Europe trend in this country is so dangerous and so wrong. I mean, I really feel very, very strongly about this, that this endless debate, should we be in or out, and, you know, somehow everything sort of detracts from our sovereignty and our existence and our own profile. I find that just totally unacceptable, and it really alienates me from many people. I mean, I don't think I know many individuals who feel like that, but I cannot bear to hear William Hague or Portillo talk about these European issues anymore, because that just jars on me. As for Mrs. Thatcher yesterday, so you see, I feel British enough.
Could I ask you more about the post-war situation in Austria and how it came to terms with the relationship to the Holocaust history? First of all, this sort of post-war period, you were obviously going there and knew what the situation was. So could you tell me your own view of this, Hella?
I think I can tell you much better now what my experience then should have been, which again sounds anomalous. What I'm trying to say is that I have been able to reconstruct it now in ways which I don't think I understood at the time. I think I was probably too young, too inexperienced, and hadn't given it enough thought. It's as plain as that. No doubt I should have done. What I realize now, that in that period, which was still the period of occupation by the four powers, the difference was that Vienna was under four-power occupation. The rest of Austria was parceled up into four separate zones of occupation. I was in Vienna, the international zone, so to speak, and I was not so conscious then of all the problems that were posed by the occupation, by the way the Austrian people had reacted to the situation which they found themselves in 45. And nor was I following then, as I have now read up, the various ups and downs of the negotiations to secure a peace treaty for Austria, which is called a state treaty because Austria officially was not at war with Germany, therefore it didn't get a peace treaty. It got a state treaty because it had been annexed by Germany. That happened in 55, and of course I was there on my first post-war visit to Austria before the state treaty had been signed. But I have no detailed recollection of what I knew then. What I know now, of course, is that Austria during the 10 years of occupation had become a sort of not the plaything of the of, but certainly had become a geographic tool in the emerging Cold War, with the Western powers looking at Austria in certain ways, the Soviet Union in a very different way. I now realize that the Soviet Union initially had assumed that Austria would vote communist and that they could establish their influence over Austria simply by so-called democratic ways. When the Russians discovered that the Austrians were not communists and were not prepared to vote communist, that the country was divided between a sort of right of center conservative party, the Austrian People's Party, and the socialists, who were certainly by no stretch of the imagination communists, plus of course quite a large element of former Nazis who again were not going to vote communist, they realized that Austria would not fall into their lap. The Western allies thought for a long time that Austria could be used as some kind of a bulwark against the Soviet Union. So they all had different interests in Austria, but the one thing that none of them had at the center of their calculation is what kind of a country Austria should become, what kind of a country Austria was. And before the end of the war, which again strikes me as quite extraordinary when I think about it now, is that the Western allies with the Soviet Union had signed a declaration in which Austria was described as Hitler's first victim. And of course the Austrians after the war used that to build up their own national identity. They wanted to unite everybody around the banner of Austria, and this was one of the ways they could do it, by saying we were all Hitler's victims and we shared in this terrible fate, and now